Americans claim to care about character. Over 4/5 would like it to be taught in public schools. 95% consider a president's character to be important. Yet, the institutions that are charged with the task have consistently fallen short, and too little effort has been made to understand the importance of character and the strategies that can best develop and support it. In her new book, Character, What It Means and Why It Matters, Deborah Rohde discusses the importance of character and the role it plays in education, law, and politics. Deborah Rohde is the Ernest McFarland Professor of Law and the Director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford University. Again, the name of the book is Character, What It Means and Why It Matters. And we welcome Deborah Rohde to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
What brought you to the subject of wanting to write about character?
Well, I teach professional ethics and leadership, and there's such a need for both at this moment. And I think, you know, it should come as no surprise that these issues have moved center stage, particularly given our current political era. 95% of Americans think, for example, that a president's character is important, but they don't vote that way. 2/3 of Americans didn't think that Donald Trump had strong moral character, and 62 million voted for him anyway. So that disconnect between what we say is important and what we actually value in voting, in schools, in law, really, I thought, was important to bring to the fore of public consciousness, especially at this historical moment.
When you talk about disconnect, how much of that do you think comes from not a true understanding of what character is?
Well, I think most people have a pretty clear sense of the qualities that they associate with people of character. You know, honesty, integrity, kindness. There's a lot of ink spilled among philosophers and psychologists about what exactly we mean and how that may have changed somewhat over time. But the core virtues have been pretty stable since, you know, Aristotle wrote about them. The real, I think, disconnect comes in the way that we don't really act on them in our public lives.
You point out in the book, of course, that we don't do enough to develop it. We don't do enough to support it. Have we ever done that?
Well, I think there's always been some measure of hypocrisy in how we want to think about ourselves in the world and how we actually conduct our daily lives. That, I don't think, has changed. But I do think that the sort of sense of importance of character has, you know, gone up and down over historical periods. And there was somewhat of a revival in the late 20th century and then moved to an era of increasing materialism. And, you know, you can see some of the difference in when you ask college students what they think is most important in life. And, you know, 40 years ago, it was, you know, having an important sense of the good life. And now it's increasingly measured in terms of wealth and recognition. So there's been some change and not necessarily in a good direction.
What is the relationship between character and morality?
Well, I think most people think of morality as a fundamental part of character, but you know, most psychologists, I think, will tell you that character is based on what they think of as both ethical values and what they think of as sort of behavioral capacities, grit and perseverance. So you need not just a moral compass, but the real commitment to act in light of what your ethical values tell you.
You write in the book about the importance of promoting a moral climate in schools. How do you do that? How do you involve students to promote that climate?
Well, I think one thing that you do is try to make sure that the policies and practices of the educational system reinforce those values. I'm not big on, you know, sort of these, you know, a virtue a week kind of superficial approaches in which people pay lip service to, you know, today's Tuesday, so we're going to talk about kindness. I think you have to reinforce the values in concrete actions and policies. And one of the best things to do is service learning. You know, get students involved at early ages in contributing to social causes and people less fortunate than themselves, and then giving them an opportunity to reflect on those experiences. Also, teaching values through literature and case studies can be really important. Getting students involved in thinking about a cause that they care about that's broader than themselves, and thinking about ways that they can contribute to positive social change around those issues that they identify can be a really useful enterprise. And, of course, I think you have to pay more attention to forces that drive cheating behavior and what can be done to better remedy and prevent it. We really have, I think, done a good job in identifying the frequency and a terrible job in addressing the underlying causes and coming up with appropriate remedial structures.
In your chapter on character development, you end by saying, if we are truly committed to nurturing moral character in our youth, then adults will need to show more responsibility in making that a priority. What do they need to do?
Well, I think, you know, of course, it starts in the family. And, you know, kids pick up the messages less than what their parents say and more in what they do. So it's how you communicate what's important to your children. And that's, you know, honesty, integrity, contributions to others. And most of the studies of people with exemplary character find that parents were incredibly important in modeling the values of empathy, altruism, and integrity that distinguish those lives. You also want parents to be concerned with what the schools are doing and actively monitor that. We need much more, I think, attention to the ways that youth organizations and athletic teams do and don't model moral values. A lot of sports claim to be building character, but as the title of one psychology text put it bluntly, if you want to build character, try something else. And too often it's winning above all that's valued, and people place emphasis on concerns like sportsmanship at award banquets, but not in daily practice. And that needs to change.
Deborah Rohde is the author of Character, What It Means and Why It Matters. The book is published by Oxford University Press. You write in the book chapters on character in law, character in criminal justice, and character in politics. A big question alert, but I'm interested in how those three intersect and how they are separate and alone.
Well, you know, the focus on character in politics is, you know, really looks at who we put in the highest office and what kinds of qualities are essential for effective performance. And, you know, our responsibility as voters to think about the character of those who will lead us. And I think, you know, we can see now how important that really is. in terms of not just domestic policies, but how we're viewed around the world. The approval of U.S. leadership is at a Gallup low of less than a third, and three quarters of individuals around the world say they have no confidence in the current administration's willingness and ability to do the right thing. And, you know, those are deeply, I think, worrying concerns. Two-thirds of Americans think that elected politicians lack honesty and integrity, and three-quarters think that they put their own interests ahead of the country. So we're clearly not, I think, operating a political system that's designed to give people the leadership that we desperately need. And in law, you see values of character, I think, not being operationalized in an effective form. So, for example, we assume that anyone with a criminal record is a person who lacks character, and we ban them from licensed occupations without doing a more holistic consideration of their records. And that has terrible consequences in terms of denying people who may have committed one or two acts from really turning their lives around and making a decent livelihood. You know, mass incarceration has been driven by the sense that people who commit one serious crime deserve and need very extended prison sentences. And, you know, in point of fact, most of the research suggests that long sentences are not an effective deterrent and don't affect the underlying risk factors that fuel crime and recidivism, factors that have little to do with character and everything to do with poverty, lack of education, employment, mental health difficulties, substance abuse, and so forth. And we really need to focus much more on those underlying problems if we want to give people really a chance to turn their lives around. By a huge margin in this country, three-quarters of the people would prefer to spend tax dollars on prevention rather than prisons, and our policies need to catch up.
Going back to the political for a moment, it does fascinate me that our capacity for this seems to have changed. So things that would have brought down presidents and candidates in the past seem to be okay now. And I'm interested in how much of that reflects our character and our moral development, and ultimately how much that shows of the individual and our quote-unquote trust in them.
Well, I think, you know, certainly our capacity to think about character in politics reflects broader cultural trends. So there's been an enormous change in attitudes, for example, towards extramarital sexual conduct over the last half century, and that's reflected in the way that we treat politicians who have less than exemplary personal lives around those issues. And, you know, we know that a large percentage of presidents, some say over half, had some extramarital sexual conduct. And there's no evidence that there's much of a correlation between that kind of behavior and effectiveness in office. So, you know, FDR was unfaithful to his wife, but honest in politics. And the, you know, other presidents who were exemplary in their marital lives are not viewed as having been terribly good presidents. So I think we have to sort of be wary about letting our views on certain forms of personal behavior spill over into our assessments of the qualities that are valuable in presidents. But certainly, you know, some of the behavior that I think, you know, may have been tossed off, for example, in the last election, Donald Trump's notorious infidelity and self-confessed grabbing really displays an attitude toward women that does reflect a deeper strain of character, and people ought to think seriously, because at least politicians at the highest levels of office perform a symbolic function. It's, you know, they represent who we are as a nation, who we want to be, who we want our children to look up to, and that kind of symbolic role is sometimes as important as the policies that particular politicians push.
Does it say something about our character if we are supporting a candidate who has great lapses in their character?
Well, I think we really need to think about the role that character necessarily plays once a leader is in office. Most people think that policies are more important than character, but oftentimes, circumstances change. No one can predict all the situations that are going to confront a leader in office. You want people who can adapt to new information and constraints. And also, a lot of policy positions are driven by the polls. And once people get in office, they can move in different directions. So you want people of character to make appropriate adjustments. And I think not valuing those core principles of honesty and integrity that can unite and inspire a country really shortchanges us in what we need in leadership. As Peggy Noonan, who is a former Republican speechwriter, once put it, character is everything. A president doesn't need to be clever. You can hire clever, but you can't buy courage and decency or rent a strong moral sense. And those values, I think, need to be much more in the public's consciousness when they get in the voting booth.
Final note, the book is dedicated to Thurgood Marshall. You have a beautiful photo that you took of him at the very beginning of the book. You clerked for the Supreme Court Justice. Give us a sense of how he played, and he figures prominently in this book. And I'm interested in how you look to him when in regards to the overall subject of character.
Well, I think he, I have a chapter on profiles in social justice, and it includes Marshall along with Nelson Mandela and Mahatma Gandhi. And I think one of the sort of striking things about Marshall is, of course, he dedicated his career to civil rights work. He was a man of extraordinary courage. He risked his life on numerous occasions in arguing cases in a hostile South. He had enormous leadership skills. People just respected his core virtues of honesty and integrity and commitment, and he could unify them around an agenda. And, he was also just a modest man. Inscribed above the front entrance of the court are the words "equal justice under law," and one of his colleagues noted on Marshall's at his memorial service that no one did more to make those words a reality than Thurgood Marshall. He, when asked how he wanted to be remembered, was a lot more modest. He said he wanted to be known for doing what he could with what he had. And the longer I looked at character, the more I really respect that aspiration and the life it reflected. And I think after his death, a reporter summed it up. He said, "Not all great men are good men," and Marshall was both.
The name of the book is Character, What It Means and Why It Matters. The book is published by Oxford. Deborah Rohde, thank you so much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for caring about these issues.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Character, What It Means and Why It Matters by Deborah Rohde, published by Oxford University Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.